Stories have a primal power to ignite our imaginations and bring us together as humans. Our shared history features iconic leaders who've inspired us by using narrative to frame our collective experiences. In the current era, we see business leaders using stories more often as well. In this two-part episode, we'll hear from a storytelling expert about why and how leaders should use stories.
You've got your strategy. That's the first part of it. That's the, dare I say, easy part. The hard part now is to get those who are with you to go to the top of the hill because you have inspired them to go.
That's Scott Halford, an internationally renowned keynote speaker, educator, and advisor. He works worldwide to educate audiences about emotional intelligence, the neuroscience of achievement, effective performance, and the success we create when we understand the intricacies of human interaction. Scott is the author of two best-selling books, Be a Shortcut, which is based on emotional intelligence and influence, and Activate Your Brain. Scott's been telling stories throughout his career, first as an Emmy Award-winning writer and producer, and then as a professional speaker. He's recognized as a certified speaking professional by the National Speakers Association, and in 2014, they inducted him into their NSA Speaker Hall of Fame. He holds an executive master's degree from the Neuro Leadership Institute. In this first part of my conversation with Scott, he explains how the human brain is wired to be moved by stories and how leaders can harness that power.
The secret sauce. The thing we want to pay attention to is the different neurochemicals or the neurotransmitters that cause and induce certain feelings.
I'm Meryl McDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and to gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. And now, Scott Halford. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to talk about storytelling.
It's a great topic, and I'm excited to be here.
I'm really interested in and really believe in the whole concept that what we focus on manifests itself. Mm-hmm. And I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that and how focus really drives positive or negative brain chemicals.
You've just said something that actually has been backed up by science. The fact is that your brain can pay attention to only so many things in the environment. There are about 40 things per second that the cognitive brain can pay attention to. And so what we want to do is start putting intention in front of us. And that means that we have to figure out what we want to manifest. So that is kind of the truism of the world, because our brains are wired with 5 times more architecture to see danger and threat than it is for reward. So if you want to see the things that are magnificent, that inspire people, that get people to laugh and to cry and to love, if you want them to see awe, if you want them to feel a little bit weary, then we have to point them at those things. We have to point them at the positives in the world, because the brain doesn't have the kind of muscle to see that. It puts that at the bottom of the chart because it's not going to hurt you. But what the brain didn't think about when it was getting evolved way back when is that it didn't understand that that is the chemistry that people wish to be doused in. And so you will manifest negative if you wish to see negative, and it will encompass you, and it will take on its effort like wildfire inside your organization, because people believe negative information before they do positive. If you want them to see positive, you have to say it again and again and again. And just when you're bored of it, that's when they are beginning to see it. You have to manifest it for other people as a leader, meaning that this is what we're going to see, and you just keep them going.
I'm really curious, what role does storytelling play in really creating positive brain chemicals?
Well, the fact is that stories create images in the brain. And the one thing that we don't have any kind of legion over is what is the image that's going on in every single person's brain who's listening. So what we want to do is actually create a story that creates a crystallized kind of concept in everybody's brain. What happens is when you're in a group of people listening, is the whole group gets the same image, you hope, at the same time. And the effect is powerful throughout the audience. You can almost feel it just hit one person after the next. And the chemistry is incredibly powerful, because when people do something we call entraining, meaning that they basically are going at the same electrical event in the brain, it's like a concert that you're at in a big, huge stadium, and the band gets really quiet and they do a ballot. Everybody listens, and you can hear a pin drop across the entire stadium because everybody's entrained at the same frequency at the same time. And it's the thing that the art critics write about the next day.
So this is an example, I assume, of if one were giving a presentation in front of a large audience. Is that right?
Exactly. And when you're doing it in front of an audience, the entrainment is something that you can't repeat. But stories have a way of bringing people in, because when you create a story that simplifies the concept in such a way that it brings the same concept that you want that listener to hear, you know that you're on the same page because you can see it in their face and you can see it actually in how they respond to whatever it is that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think about the phrase, you know, commanding an audience. And I imagine that's somewhat of what you're referring to.
Exactly. And the command is something that a lot of people don't understand because they think that they're going to tell a story beginning to end, every ounce and every detail about it. But there are so many different things that you can do to basically truncate and shorten that story and get to the main pieces, because you're really trying to induce a feeling. If you tested them 30 minutes later and said, what did Scott just say in terms of a story? They wouldn't be able to tell you all of the words, but they would say, he just made me think about, or I felt as if. And that's the thing that a story will induce.
So I would imagine those listening now are asking themselves, well, how do you do that?
It's magic. It's
Well, we hope you're going to give us the secret.
The secret sauce. The thing we want to pay attention to is, from a neurochemical standpoint, if you look at the different neurochemicals or the neurotransmitters that cause and induce certain feelings, you can reduce it down to that. And it is pretty reductionist, but the fact is that there are three kind of chemicals that we want to see come at play. One is dopamine. Most people have heard of dopamine. It's the neurotransmitter that, among other things, causes us to feel joy and causes us to feel elation. And it's kind of like, you know, you've got a child in a swing and they go, push me again, daddy, push me again, push me again. And that's kind of what dopamine does. It says, do it again. You feel so incredibly elated that you want it again. So you want people to basically feel that feeling of, I want more. The second neurochemical is oxytocin. And oxytocin, you may have heard of that one as well. And that is basically the bonding hormone or the hormone of trust. And when we have oxytocin present, it makes us feel really close to the person. It says, if we feel like we have a personal connection, even though we might be sitting in an audience, or if you're in a room, boardroom full of 10 people, every person feels like you're talking directly to them, because the story is, it feels connected and very, very personal. And the third one is norepinephrine, and that's in the family of adrenaline. And that's where we feel energized and excited. It's like, go, I want to do it. Go, go, go. So we've got motivation, we've got bonding, and then we've got, I want to do it again. I want to feel that joy. A story can basically be tracked according to those. If you look at how they are laid out, the story's laid out. And so that you can begin to understand that at the end, in my opinion, we either want a do it again, or just a deep, deep connection. And that is done through the words that you have and the story trajectory that you build when you write the story.
As you talk about the business point, it kind of gets me to my next question, which is, often leaders are in a situation where they're giving a presentation on something not very personal, right? The company strategy, for example. Yeah. How do you weave in the stories and really use them to help people understand where we're going with the business and why?
You know, it's a perennial issue for customers, because the leader has been living with the thoughts of that strategy for how long, right? Maybe a few years even. It's been boiling, it's been burbling, it's been discussed casually and not so casually with other leaders. And so by the time they get to the place of presenting the strategy that they have lived with so long, the people listening have heard it for the very first time. They don't even know what to think about it. They don't know what the implications are. They don't know what the stumbles and falls are. They don't know what the upsides are. And so a leader has to be able to encapsulate and embody the work that he has brought to that moment in a way that brings them to that moment. So just telling your strategy is literally, it's like a one-dimensional, you've given a one-dimensional story, and that is that you just gave out a bunch of words and you have not connected any feeling to them. And because you've not done that, and because the brain will literally apply emotion to every word you have, every piece of information that enters into your brain, enters into the brain through the living room of the brain, the hypothalamus, and it decides if it's going to become cognitive, something we think about, or if it's going to become emotional, something we react to. And so therefore, everything, the hypothalamus being in the emotional part of the brain, everything connects to an emotion. Well, if you don't choose which direction you want it to go, and it can go 15 directions, it will go a direction. You just don't get to choose which one. And then that's when you have dissension and you have condescension. You've got all the dissensions that you could possibly want. You've got confusion. And that's exactly what you don't want. So it's more than the fact that, ta-da, you've got your strategy. That's the first part of it. That's the, dare I say, easy part. The hard part now is to get those who are with you to go to the top of the hill and maybe not have all the details, but they go anyway because they know you, they trust you, and that's assuming trust, and they want to go because you have inspired them to go. So there's a lot of work before that strategy should ever come out of anyone's mouth. And I think that, at least with the clients I've worked with, I think because they're analytical, they figure it's done because the spreadsheet says it's done. But now we have a different spreadsheet, and it includes human beings, and those are ticking bombs. You know, those are ones that you have no idea when they're going to go off. And you want to get them all in the same place at the same time and evoke the emotion you want to evoke, not the one that is just going to be default in an individual's head. That's what story does for it. So it brings everybody to the point at the same time.
And, you know, I really want to come back to you talking about also the fact that a leader's job isn't to motivate, but to inspire.
Yeah.
Talk more about that. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. So, you know, if you take motivation and you look at the science behind it, it's difficult because we can't see anything in the brain around it. And so if you look at, you know, some of this science that was done at the University of Oregon with a guy by the name of Ethan Gross. And what he did is he took subjects, put them under a skull cap that measured the circuitry in the brain, and he put them into an activity. And the activity was, he put a toothbrush in their hand, and he said, I want you all to think about how to brush your teeth. And they all did. And each one of the separate recordings came up with the same neural network of circuits that turned on. Then he had them take a break. He had them come back, gave them the toothbrush back. And he said, now I want you to think about why you brush your teeth. And they did. And they all came up with another neural circuit. And it was a different one than the first one. And then he had them go rest, come back, toothbrush in hand, had them now think about how and why you brush your teeth. And what they recorded was this constant confusion, this quick jumping between the circuits, because both circuits could not be on at the same time. And when Ethan broke down this and he began to look at goal attainment or getting into the place of motivation, found out that we need a how and we need a why. Because on the days when you say, why am I doing this? You really do want an answer, right? And so now you have some of the kind of the part of what we think of as motivation is, why am I doing this? Because this is hard. And if I don't have a why, I'm not doing it. And then you have the, how do I do this? I know why, but I don't know how to. And so now we have the part that says I've got to bulk you up with skill. If you were going to look at a motivational theory, I think that that's probably closest to it. But what we have is this difficulty in creating momentum, and momentum is what inspiration is about. Momentum is the thing that just gets you started. It's the thing that says when you're laying in bed and your alarm clock goes off early, early, early because you plan to work out. And you lay there and you hit the snooze button. You go, oh, geez, why do I need to do it? Why did I do this? Well, you know why? Because you want to get healthier, or you want to lose weight, or you want to be stronger, whatever it is. How do I do it? Well, I know. You get out of bed, you put your feet on the floor, and you get dressed and you go.
And how does that work neurologically speaking?
What we know is if you wait for the motivation, it may never come. I don't want to mow the lawn. I know how to mow the lawn, but I don't want to do it, and I don't ever want to do it. And so when inspiration hits, it's when we watch the example of a human being who does something they absolutely do not want. They don't want to do it, but they know they have to do it. And they have to be the one to do it. And we're met with that every single day. Every one of us is met with things we have to do, we don't want to do, but we have to be the one to do it. It has to be done. And so you get up and you understand the neurochemistry that happens when you just get a check mark. So there you are with your to-do activities, right? And you get something done. What do? You check it off, right? There's not a soul on the planet that when they get something done from their to-do list, they check it off. No one leaves it blank, right? Some people get to the end of the day and they add things to the list that they got done and then they check those off. And there's a reason why. And it's because that check mark makes you feel so amazing. And why? It's because there's dopamine. And that dopamine says, get it done, get it done. And once you start going, it's amazing. You'll be going and all of a sudden you've done it, right? We've all done that where we start to go like, I don't want to do this. And you clean, like the sink. And all of a sudden now the whole house is sparkling clean. And it's because you created momentum. And that momentum came from dopamine. And the only way that dopamine got going was to ignite it, to activate it. And activated it for no other reason than to go. And when you went, you got inspired. Inspiration is about a place you can get to. It's not about why am I getting there? People find their own motivation along the way, but momentum is found because you began it.
Well, I'm really processing. Yeah. Here are a couple of things that are going through my head. One is, so how does a leader start that momentum from an inspiration standpoint? Because it sounded like getting going actually inspires one instead of the other way around.
Yeah. It's there's a lot of talk about visions and missions before they ever happen. And one of the sociologists out there who is doing work on what changes a culture takes a look at it and says, nothing in your culture will change. Nothing that you put in those beautiful vision statements and mission statements, that won't occur until there is a structure in place that allows for those words to come alive. And so what that means is, here's an example for at GE. When they decided that they wanted to go down the aisle of becoming digital and becoming fancy and software and that kind of thing, well, nobody ever thought of them as that. They were cubicles and they were in research labs and that was about it. They didn't have the areas of, the Silicon Valley with ping pong and, great food and open and, music playing and people wearing jeans. They just didn't have that. That was not their culture. So in order for that even to be a possibility, they had to put somebody in the place of being the chief people experience officer. They went around to facilities and they began to change them physically so that when people said, you want me to do that? Oh, it's already in place. You've begun that piece. So the leader has to start the momentum. They have to put things in place for the strategy to kind of get the grease that it needs in order for the people to slide down that slide into the strategy. So they have to begin the momentum. They have to say, here are the things that we have in place for you so that you can do what we've asked you to do. You have to show that you not only came up with the strategy, you've already started it. So the strategy begins way before they ever present it. It's just now that employees are seeing it all put into a nice format. And now they're being tasked with jumping into what's already kind of been begun. The leader has to start it and they have to be an example of it. I think a leader, if they could understand one thing, and that is this, that they really are mere mortals. And they're mere mortals. They've got a whole group of people on a journey with them. And their job is to go out on the ledge while the people are behind them. And they're going to go down the path, maybe 3, 4, maybe 5 steps ahead of them. And they're going to look around and they're going to test the waters and they're going to test the security of the bridge that they're about to go over. They're going to test all of the different elements that might hurt their people and that might help the people. And then they're going to turn back around and they're going to trot back to where the people are. And they're going to say, this is what you're seeing now, but where we're going on the journey is over there. And let me tell you, these are the things that we're going to rely upon. And you're going to tell them that it's okay where they're going. And you're going to tell them that not only is it okay, but it's better where you're going. I think that leaders get this idea that their job is to know all the answers. And what a horrible space they put themselves in when they do that.
Right. And, it reminds me of Margaret Wheatley, who I'm a big fan of hers. And she always talks about leaders learning to go from being a hero to a host.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I do too. And the whole concept of feeling, it's exactly that you have to have all the answers. But really what you need to do is host the intelligence of the crowd.
Exactly. That's exactly it. That, yeah, that's beautifully done. And I think if they get that, their job is to go out, look, create the strategy. Now you got to come back and tell me from my perch where I'm sitting, what journey did you go on to get there? How do you know it's okay there? How am I going to get there? Are you bringing me, you know, kind of thing. And those are the questions that employees have. And those are the stories that you get to tell. It's the journey between where they are and where you want them to be. And you got to take me there mentally, because just to jump, most people don't have that kind of faith in the people running their companies.
And Scott, put yourself in the shoes of a leader who isn't really sure it's going to be okay for everybody. How do you lead the team then?
I think that, you know, if you know that you're going to downsize X percent of the workforce because you just simply don't need that many bodies, and you know your stock prices aren't going to allow that. I think first off, you have to come to the reality, come to the place of understanding that then the reality is that there are times when you have to let a whole swath of people go. I think if you let the whole swath of people go, and there is a reason, and there is also an explanation, and there is also fairness that is played out. There are rules by which this is going to happen, and people understand that. They might not like it, but they understand it. So I think before a leader gets to the place of standing in front of people, that kind of information has to be understood and done. If it's not fair, that's where most people begin to give you the nightmares that you have. If it doesn't feel like it's dealt out in a fair way, if it feels like there's nothing but favorites happening, you're just going to have a mess going on. I think leaders, again, there's so much work to be done before anything is announced. Because when you announce something and you go after it, if you didn't sit and if you didn't spend time with the HR or the people who are consultants who live with this every day, I mean, leaders don't live with this stuff every day. What they live with is, you know, results. That's where their head's at. Well, a result means that we have to cut out this group of people. Okay, great. Go ahead and do it. Well, and you don't know why, and you don't have a great explanation. You don't have empathy. You're going to not attract a whole heck of a lot of people now when you need to. I think it's all of the thinking that goes on before it. And if I were a leader, I would make sure I understood that I don't understand the people part if you don't. Because there is as much data in understanding how people will talk about you as there is how they will talk about that spreadsheet that you so finally understand in 4-point font on 250 pages. You know, it's like, that's the part that they miss, is the part that's going to impact people.
Right. And this also leads to a question around, really, from a neuroscience standpoint, how can we most effectively deal with a feeling of lack of control? And this is, of course, driven by my own personal point of view that we're never really fully in control. It's an illusion. And first of all, do you agree with that? And the other is, if you feel you can't control everything, how do you use neuroscience to think about mastering yourself?
Yeah, that I do agree. I agree. I even take it a step beyond. I think that, you know, I was told one time, Scott, the day that you understand how very little, if anything, you control, that's the day you will be free. And I'm like, oh no. You know, oh really? And we don't control a whole heck of a lot, you know?
Right.
When a leader comes to grips with what they can control, they can't really control their employees. What they can do is inspire their employees. They can show them, you know, hey, you know, yeah, I'm angry too, but look at over here. I thought about doing this because I don't like it over there. So I'm going to go over here. I go, wow, what a great idea. That's inspiration. If they can remember that they are a mere mortal, that I keep coming back to that people put on, you know, they put on jeans on the weekend. They hang out, and that no matter how successful in the eyeballs of the success definers out there, no matter how successful they become, they are not exempt from the difficulties in life. They are not exempt from fear. They're not exempt from doubt, and they're not exempt from all of the uncertainty that is facing us every single day. And so I need to know that you look like you know what is happening, but that look is fueled by one very strong fact, and that is that you've been out on the ledge 3 to 5 steps ahead, and that you come back and you say, this is all I know, that in the next 3 to 5 steps, we'll be okay. Beyond that, give me some time. I have to walk the next five. And that metaphor for me is so strong that it just basically is saying, I'm human. I'm gonna be the guy who goes out there. I'm not looking for you to give me slaps on the back because I'm doing a great job. It's my job. And so I'll do it. And I'm scared too. But here's what I think. I think that with the team that we have here in this company and the team that we have here in this room, I would take this team anywhere I would go because you are going to be the ones to make this all so successful. I think that when they humanize themselves, as opposed to create such distance between them and their people, that they're just not going to be in trouble. That's what I think. They've got to put themselves with the people. That's hard for leaders, I think, because we groom them to be, you know, infallible.
I'd like to pivot into how we tell stories more effectively. But before we do that, can you just recap what we have so far?
I think that if we were going to do a breakdown, it's a quick breakdown. We're going to do a quick breakdown on what the neurochemicals do. I would say this. The neurochemicals that create certain feelings are attached to some real definable things. If you look at oxytocin is created without ingesting anything into your body, by the way. It's created by doing one of four of these things. One is laughter. It's one of the quickest ways to create bonding. People like people they laugh with. So if you want to feel connection with your audience, get them to laugh. The second thing is if they feel familiarity, liking, loving, familiarity, right? They don't have to love you, but liking you is important. And familiarity, that's where they're liking. It's like you were there too. When I was doing XYZ, this is what I did. So they see that you've gone through the trenches with them. They feel bonded to you. So loving, liking, familiarity. The next thing is generosity. You know, when we're generous, when all of us are generous and we do things that allow us to think outside of ourselves, we think about the people who did it with us. And so if you're doing a Habitats for Humanity and you've got a story around that, well, there's probably people are liking and loving and feeling familiar. They're telling stories. They're bonding in ways. And then they're also collaborating, which is the fourth thing. Collaboration in the sense that you have a team of people who are willing to get the feedback of the team on a regular basis. They basically create a whole shop of editors for themselves. I come to you and I say, Meryl, I'm stuck on this. Would you look at this and just tell me what I'm missing? And when you say something like, tell me what I'm missing, what you're saying is I'm open for editing. And you edit it for me. And I edit for you. And good editors in your life help you to be the best you possibly can. And that creates a bonding because it says, Meryl stopped. She took her time. I know she's really busy. And she came up with this one pearl of wisdom that is going to change everything. And I love her, right? It's that's oxytocin. So then when you go over to norepinephrine, the things that create excitement and interest, and the old saying is that where interest goes, attention grows. Where attention grows and interest goes, that's where we build skill. And so getting interested in something, so getting people interested in something typically takes on the idea of learning something new. So novelty grows targets in the brain. It grows things in the brain. So things that are brand new create new neural pathways in the brain. Well, that is a pretty exciting kind of thing. And so you have novelty and interest. Those two things will create this excitement that is really important. So getting people interested in your mission and your vision, you've got to get to the place of where it really is interesting. If they just go, yeah, those are nice words you sat down on a retreat in a weekend and made, are you really interested? And they'll see it in you. It's very contagious. And the last one is dopamine. It's getting started. It's creating momentum, and then it's creating mastery. And people get dopamine when they are on the path of going down the domain that they chose and they have surrounded themselves with and are afforded the company of people who help them to achieve even more mastery.
That makes me wonder then, what drives us to want mastery or to support others in achieving their goals?
If you know the mastery that you're trying to achieve, the domain that you're trying to work on, if you know what that is at a very early time, your ability to become that master and to understand that you don't control all of the world. But if you did say that you controlled something, it would be this little fiefdom over here. That if your board of directors was struggling with a question and they were debating back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and they did not know what to do, and you were sitting, you know, in the background and you decided, I'm going to raise my hand. Even though it's scary, I'm going to raise my hand. And you raise your hand because why? You don't know all of the things that they're dealing with, but that one thing that they just mentioned, I can wake up in the morning, put my feet on the ground, and I know how to do it, and I know how to do it well. What would you raise your hand for? That's the mastery that the brain is really seeking for you to feel accomplished, to feel completion. And the last thing of all of that is that the brain looks for two things all day, right? In general, the general two things, not the attention things, but the general things. Danger and threats, that's number one. And the second thing is incomplete tasks, incomplete tasks. And so as you go to attain that completion, completion is, did I do something today that I could get a check mark for? You get at the end of your days wondering, God, I did so many things and I felt like I got nothing done. Why? Because you were busy helping everybody else get their check mark. That's fine. But somewhere along the way, every day, you got to get a check mark for yourself. Completion. Every day, you have to get to a place of feeling like, ching, I did that. That's what gives you momentum in an overall sense.
So what do you think is the ultimate personal goal for a leader?
I think it has to be contentment. I think that's the Holy Grail. I think it's a place of not things. You know, you become a world of people who have fallen in love with things that can't love us back. But you can love yourself. You can get to the place of understanding that I am content with this. The contentment, the place of contentment in the world of neuropsychology and in biology is this place of equilibrium that is so incredibly luscious that it's really difficult for anyone to replicate it because it's different for everyone. You know, the one thing I know about leaders is that they don't know what kind of example that they are. They have no idea. I mean, when you become the president of the United States, you have to understand that every single hair you move means something in the world. And we've seen that happen with every president that has ever been on record, that all they have to do is sneeze and the sneezing industry is either in trouble or they are going to make billions. And so as a leader of a company, you have that same grave responsibility. It's not for the faint of heart. People are watching you and they are watching you with eagle eyes and they will basically attach to you ideas and activities and thoughts that you had no idea that they possibly could. And so it means you have to be incredibly aware of yourself. So I think if you're not content as a leader, I'm going to see this frenetic kind of chaotic person going all over the place. And so I don't really know what you stand for and I don't know where we're going. Contentment is the thing I would love to see in those guys. I don't see a lot of contentment in that realm. The ones you do, you know it's there. It just feels, you feel like you are in a place of grace. When you're sitting there with them, they are just one of you and you're one of them because they're content. They're good. They're not trying to be something they're not. They're a leader with a job. Contentment is not without edge. It's not without urgency. And it's not without, you know, really big goals. What it knows is that sometimes it feels really amazing to be the catcher at the end of a day where you were being thrown balls over here, over there, over here, under, above, boom. And on one day, you can catch every single one of them. And on another day, you miss every one of them. And the fact is that your skill didn't change. What changed was your attitude. And that attitude, how you approach your work, how you approach your life, if it's approached with that whole idea of gratitude and I'm here, I'm going to do what I can do to be what needs to be the best, not to be my best, but to be the best for the organization, which is very different. I think you feel contented at the end of the day. Do you feel, you might be sore, but you feel really good.
This has just been fantastic. Thank you so much for bringing that up.
You are welcome.
I love the science behind Scott's approach to storytelling. Let's recap a few of the learnings. First, being clear about your intention is paramount to capturing the imagination. As leaders, we must be diligent in pointing people toward what we want them to focus on or to bring to life. That's because the human brain, which absorbs about 40 things per second, filters out almost everything. It will see what we tell it to see. And it's programmed to see more negative information, such as dangers, than positives, such as rewards. So in day-to-day settings, leaders must frequently and consistently share the positives, simply to counter the negatives. Second, stories tap into different neurotransmitters that activate specific feelings, which can support and reinforce your broader intention. Dopamine induces joy and elation and leads us to want more. Oxytocin fosters building trust. And norepinephrine can cause us to feel energized and excited. Through stories, you can trigger the appropriate neurotransmitter to support the intention behind your business message. This is much more effective than sharing your ideas through data alone, which gives a one-dimensional view of your strategy or direction. Stories bring in the thinking and emotions behind your work. The characters and situations induce feelings in your audience, helping them to relate better to you and gain a much richer understanding of the undertaking. Third, contrary to the belief that inspiration leads to action, Scott says from a neuroscience standpoint, action comes first. As he puts it, the world belongs to people who begin things. Action creates momentum, which then leads to inspiration. Motivation, he adds, will come from each individual intrinsically. The leader's job is to inspire, not motivate, and this often means taking the first step when pursuing a goal. Others watching are more likely to join once a journey gets underway because as humans, we're wired to feel accomplished. We naturally seek to complete our tasks or to help others achieve theirs. When others join in, we gain more momentum triggered by dopamine, and that leads to inspiration. Through strategic storytelling, leaders can highlight progress, showcase momentum gained, and in doing so, inspire more people to come along. Last but certainly not least, leaders should seek contentment. That's the holy grail, Scott says, the place of equilibrium in neuropsychology and biology. It's also the place of grace from which a leader can move forward, focused, assured, and inspirational. I can't thank Scott enough for this most enlightening conversation. We have more to come from Scott in part two of our conversation, where he talks about the mechanics of storytelling for business leaders. Until then, thanks for joining us on Let Go and Lead.